precipitation, some light icing possible, and rain showers for southern and southeast New Hampshire.
Just across the week.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Keith Shields, and this is The Exchange. How will you remember 2011? Well, if you lived in the Granite State this year, you may do it a number of ways. Political watchers may remember it as the year that new Republican majorities took over the State House and Senate, that there was a major budget showdown, and when presidential candidates circled the state, shaking hands and making speeches hoping to get your first-in-the-nation primary vote. Others may look at 2011 through economic eyes, another year of tough numbers, ups and downs, and the possibility of a glimmer of hope in the final months. You may think back to that tropical storm that hit the state hard, or that Halloween where you worried more about your snow shovel than your trick-or-treat plans. Some will look to the year as a beginning and remember that 2011 was the time that an Occupy movement was born. Others may mark it as a year we lost a few well-known Granite State politicians. While we here on The Exchange were able to blow out our 15th anniversary candle as a talk show. Today on The Exchange, we look back at the events that topped the Granite State headlines this year. It's our annual New Hampshire Newsmakers of the Year show, the 2011 edition. We begin with a story that once again dominated headlines, the economy. For another year, uncertainty reigned. The unemployment rate improved some, and New Hampshire's numbers stayed better than the national average. But housing prices fluctuated, while many Granite State businesses reliant on exports watched the teetering European economy. Meanwhile, the opening of a prison and biomass plant gave North Country residents hope for possible better times ahead. To look deeper into how the New Hampshire economy fared this year, I spoke with Ross Cattell, an economist and professor of management at the Whittemore School of Business and Economics at the University of New Hampshire. He's also forecast manager for the New England Economic Partnership. Ross Cattell, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Keith.
Well, Ross, if memory serves me right, this is the third year in a row that you're sitting down with us talking about another year of a struggling economy. But are we doing any better now than when we talked last year?
We're in about the same situation, unfortunately. 2011 was a lot like 2010, and we're ending the year maybe a little better place in 2011 to 2010. But what really underlies the economy right now and concerns most people is that uncertainty and the downside risk potential that's out there. So we've continued to have this delayed recovery from the Great Recession. And every time we think the economy is going to gain some momentum or going to add some jobs in New Hampshire and nationally, there's that setback. Initially, in 2011, we had the spike in gasoline prices that really put a deflator on any kind of momentum we had early on in 2011. Then we had the Japanese earthquake. And then towards the end of 2011, the economic news is dominated by the European debt crisis and now the political deadlock in Washington around extending the budget and then the tax cuts, and people's confidence continues to be down in 2011, much like 2010.
And so where have we seen improvements this year?
Well, you know, if you look at some of the data, and that's usually where we start, New Hampshire unemployment rate is right now at latest figures 5.2%. That's down from 5.7% 1 year ago. Nationally, the unemployment rate is down to 8.6%, and that's down from 9.7% a year ago. And in New Hampshire, there has been some good news. Just last week, Safran, an international aerospace firm based in France, announced, along with Albany Engineering Composites, that they're going to open up a new facility in Rochester, New Hampshire, adding up to 400 jobs in advanced manufacturing and aerospace. And that's really good news and a sign that, you know, maybe we're turning the corner here and that with insurances that we have a skilled workforce and workforce education and training, we could attract good jobs to New Hampshire and add to our employment base here, which will help us recover from this recession.
And so what have been the challenges? And Roskatel, are they new challenges or old challenges that seem to have not improved?
Well, some of the challenges, or maybe the biggest challenge, is the international economy, and in particular the European debt crisis, and that really affects the U.S. economy and the New Hampshire economy and overall confidence in financial markets. And the extent of the debt difficulties and the challenges in working through them, I think, are more extensive than we thought they were at this time last year. And that reality has hit, and trying to deal with it and what the implications are going to be in New Hampshire presents a huge challenge. Also, as far as a continued challenge is, even though unemployment rate went down in New Hampshire and in the nation over the course of the past 12 months, part of the reason for the unemployment rate going down is because of workers being discouraged, dropping out of the workforce. And that is bad news because you have discouraged workers, you have consumers who lack confidence in the economy, in their economic future, and that puts a dampening on any kind of prospects for a consumer-led economic recovery.
Well, one part of the state that has struggled more than others over the past decade, Roskatel, has been the North Country. But this year, there's a new biomass plant that has plans of opening up, and the long-awaited federal prison in Berlin that received the funding it needed to open and is now taking job applications. So can we start to get optimistic about the North Country economy?
You know, I think optimistic might not be the right word. We could say signs of improvement and increased employment prospects for residents of the North Country. So I would say definitely some signs of improvement and increased job prospects. But still, the reality, there's a lot of economic challenges up in the North Countries that are going to have to be worked through. So we could be less pessimistic, we could be more hopeful, but I'm not sure I would use the word optimistic at this stage.
So another state economist, Dennis DeLay, was recently quoted about the New Hampshire economy by saying that we're in relatively good shape, but skating on thin ice. So look into your magic ball, Roskatel. Will the New Hampshire economy improve significantly in the coming year, or will you and I be sitting here once again together in late December 2012?
Yeah, well, you know, following up on Dennis's analogy, I would say the ice is thickening, but it's still not frozen. And I think that ice is not going to be frozen. We're not going to have that significant economic growth until after 2012 into 2013. I think we're going to have to wait for the presidential election, November of 2012. And we're going to have to wait for some of the difficulties in the European debt situation to be worked through to get that ice thickened and a stronger economic foundation and to have significant growth in the economy and to reduce unemployment significantly below that 5%. We're going to have to wait. Not 2012, but 2013.
Well, good news for you, though. In the coming year, a new position as the Chancellor of the Community College System of New Hampshire. What do you hope to bring to this new job?
What I hope to bring is a focus on a key area of economic competition and opportunity in New Hampshire. And what I want to focus on is ensuring there's a stronger linkage between education and the economy in New Hampshire. And the community college system of New Hampshire is really, in many respects, point central to that because we're focused in the community college system of New Hampshire on linking business and industry with education, ensuring students have the appropriate skills and training for well-paying jobs and to help industries be competitive.
And how much will all of your work examining the New Hampshire economy for all these years inform your new job?
Oh, I think that's critical to have an information and research base. And the key is to identify what are the needs of business and industry out there and to ensure that our students, that our residents have the appropriate skills, education, and training to be productive, to be gainfully employed, to earn good income, and to enhance the economic position overall of the state of New Hampshire.
Well, congratulations and best of luck to you in 2012, Ross
Cattell. Oh, thanks very much, Keith. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Ross Cattell is a professor of management at the Whittemore School of Business and Economics at UNH and forecast manager at the New England Economic Partnership. He begins his new role as chancellor for the Community College System of New Hampshire on February 1st. Days after we rang the bell into 2011, the State House went back into session. But this year, the makeup changed. Republicans dominated both the House and the Senate and began to work on a budget that GOP legislators promised would include deep cuts. The House, Senate, and governor all came out with their own versions, and finally this summer, a $10.3 billion budget was passed that included cuts to just about every department in the state. To take a look back at the legislative year, state house politics, and budget battles, I spoke with Josh Rogers, New Hampshire Public Radio's state house reporter. Josh Rogers, thanks for sitting down with me.
No problem, Keith.
Well, a new year brought new numbers to the state house, with Republicans having large majorities in both the House and Senate. Looking back, Josh, what did the Republican leaders say were going to be their top priorities going into 2011?
Rein in the size of government and try to foster an economic climate that would create more jobs. And I guess the budget's the battleground for that discussion with Democrats and the governor.
And remind us, Josh, how big of a shift was the state house this year in terms of Republicans coming over?
Well, I mean, the fallout from the 2010 elections was a wave for Republicans across the state and across the country. And certainly the New Hampshire House and the legislature in general was quite dramatic. And both chambers moved from Democratic control to 3-to-1 Republican majorities. And the House in particular had 100 new members and a big turnover. And that led to the election of Bill O'Brien as Speaker. And that set the tone that there are going to be big changes after 4 years of Democratic control, the budget and spending being Exhibit A.
Well, let's talk about Bill O'Brien. There was a lot of talk about him, the House Speaker, and his leadership style. Some called it very effective. Others called his tactics unfair, bordering on bullying. So in the end, Josh, how will the history books remember 2011 and Speaker O'Brien?
Well, a lot will depend on what happens this year. Certainly, Speaker O'Brien shepherded through a budget that, depending on how you choose to do the math, cut state spending in the neighborhood of 10%, which is more or less unprecedented in history that anyone around the state house now can remember. And he did so by exercising firm control and working in common cause with Republicans in the Senate. You know, the fallout from that budget is still largely unknown. Certainly controlling the House, particularly with so many new members, is a challenge. Speaker O'Brien ran a tight ship, as you said. Some people did criticize him for being overbearing and sort of exercising the prerogatives of the Speaker in a way that recent speakers hadn't. He was certainly not afraid to yank people off of committees if they weren't doing what he wanted, or replacing committee members with people without any policy expertise for the purpose of just voting through a policy matter. So it was a different leadership style. This year will be an interesting test to see how that wears. So the Speaker, he's an ambitious guy, and there'll be a lot on the plate, and the House is always a little chaotic, and we're coming up on an election year, so it should be interesting.
Well, let's take a look back here at the beginning of the year. What dominated the discussions and debates there were the budget. So in the end here, at least up until this point, Josh, who do you say were the biggest winners and the biggest losers of this budget?
Well, given the fact that the budget was cut to the extent that it was, it's easier to find clear losers in that people are getting less money than they did. Higher education was pretty dramatic, and so tuition is going up at UNH and at community colleges. There was changes to Medicaid taxation, and so hospitals are bearing a $250 million cut over the biennium. There are lots of social service programs as well, and the budget's now been on the books since July 1, so we're going to be able to see the impacts of those policy changes and whether or not they live up to the claims that some Democrats made that this was going to put people in danger and, in fact, kill people, or whether or not Republicans claims that this was simply responsible budgeting and spending what the state had and that some people would be able to be taken care of through private charities and churches. This will be the test of that.
Well, you mentioned the Democrats, Josh. How did they do this year in their role as the loyal opposition?
Well, it's tough when you're down 3-1. I think they believe they did what they could to point out what they would perceive as the misaligned priorities of some in Republican leadership, what they have characterized over and over again as radical approach, particularly on the budget. Certainly, they were beaten soundly in the last election, and I think Republicans were in the right to suggest that they had a mandate to try a different approach in Concord. And we'll see how that sits. It's always hard to know when there's a big wave election. Is it reflective of what the voters want or just simply who happened to be running? And we may find out come 2012.
Okay, Josh, let's take a look forward. Now that the budget has passed, what do you think are going to be the top issues of debate for the next legislative season?
Well, the budget won't go away. It rarely does, particularly in a tight economy. The repeal of same-sex marriage is going to get a great deal of scrutiny. There's going to be organization.
You're listening to New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our members, from Lincoln Financial Group and its employees, in the spirit of the season, wishing you and your loved ones the happiest of holidays and a rewarding New Year, and from the Common Man family, celebrating New Year's Eve with dining, dancing, and overnight accommodations at their inns in Plymouth and Claremont. Details at thecmaninn.com. And from St. Mary's Bank, the nation's first credit union, helping New Hampshire families and businesses grow and prosper for over 100 years. Season's greetings from St. Mary's Bank. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly cloudy across the state. A few flurries, mainly in western and northern areas. High temps near 30 degrees in the north, mid-30s in central parts of the state, and low 40s in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Keith Shields, executive producer for The Exchange. Today, for our 9th annual New Hampshire Newsmakers of the Year broadcast, we're looking at the people and events that made headlines in 2011. A new year brought a national focus to New Hampshire, as once again, first-in-the-nation primary fever hit the Granite State. Candidates hoping to be your next president flocked here, making speeches, debating each other, and interacting with the people who would be voting for them. All year, new candidates jumped into the race. Some dropped out. Some tested the water for months, while New Hampshire Secretary of State Bill Gardner once again found himself in a political chess game, with states looking to challenge our first-in-the-nation status. To look at the year of the primary, I spoke with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. He's author of the popular website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean Spiliotis, thanks for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure, Keith.
So, every presidential cycle, it seems as if campaigning for the next primary starts earlier and earlier. But this year, the primary got off to a late start, with candidates testing the waters and holding off on decisions on whether to run until midsummer. So why so late this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon. It's something that we've seen this year in comparison to previous years. It started to look like presidential campaigning was going to become a full-time four-year occupation, but things did start later this year. I think there was a bit of fatigue coming out of the midterm election on all sides, so I think people were taking a little bit of a break. I think there was a sizing up of the field to see who were going to be the likely contenders, a little bit of financial fatigue as well in terms of fundraising. It just seemed to me that people were willing to wait a little bit and see how things shaked out. And that's going to happen occasionally. We'll see if this becomes a longer-term trend or not.
Well, it wouldn't be a primary year without some state or states challenging the primary caucus process. And this year, Dean, it was Florida that began the chess game between the early states. Bill Gardner held off until early November before he declared New Hampshire the first-in-the-nation primary to be held on January 10th. So after this big game of political chicken, what do you make of the way the calendar shakes out this year?
It's actually, in many respects, very similar to the last cycle, although this time we're 2 days later than we were in 2008, and we have a bit more time between Iowa and ourselves. So I think that's good in terms of getting that last-minute retail politics in the state. You know, this front-loading is a problem in pretty much every cycle. There's a sense that other states who argue that they're more representative, larger populations, more diverse populations, different sets of economic concerns than New Hampshire, that they're not being fairly represented. So you've seen both parties try to incentivize the states to maybe move back a little bit in terms of how they apportion delegates and those types of benefits for the conventions. Yeah, I think the schedule has played out reasonably well this time. We're going to push up against the holidays, it seems, every 4 years now, that essentially Iowa will go very close to New Year's, and then you'll have the falling out from there on back into February. I think as long as there is roughly a week between each of the contests so that the candidates can shift gears from state to state, I think that's reasonable. It's unfortunate that we no longer get all of that campaigning that we used to get in January when the primary was in February. That combined with a later start, if that becomes the trend, we're looking at a shorter primary season. Now, for some folks, they're probably actually happy about that. But it does change the dynamic in terms of ability to raise funds, and it often favors the candidates who are more nationally established and can shift resources more quickly in a compressed schedule.
So 2015, hold off on our holiday plans, at least until it gets close.
This may become a new tradition. Bill Gardner threatens to hold it either between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and then we end up somewhere in the first 10 days of January.
Well, one thing that many have pointed out about this primary season is the lack of true retail politics. So candidates engaging in small house parties, town hall meetings, kissing babies. Rather, it seems more national this year. What do you make of that?
This is a trend we've been watching now for at least a decade, the renationalization of political campaigns. The initial intent of the modern primary process was to democratize and decentralize candidate selection. We now seem to be gravitating back towards a nationalized system. I think it's being driven by a number of different issues. It's being driven by advances in technology, which kind of homogenize the campaign environment across states, so there's less of a need to tailor your message from state to state because everything is kind of nationalized through instant technology. That's part of it. I think part of it is also the role of big money, the advocacy groups, the kind of money you need to run campaigns now. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars if you're going to make it all the way to the presidency. So I think that has had a big impact as well. And ironically, I think the role of presidential debates, cable media, et cetera, has given some of the lesser-known candidates an opportunity for high visibility without having to raise a lot of money or build grassroots organizations. Those are the kinds of things we typically associate with retail politics. They're hard to do. They require a lot of time and effort and money. A number of these candidates now have the ability to basically be on television for free at a very high-profile way. We've seen 5, 6, 7 million people watching some of these debates. It really has kind of supplanted the need for building a state-by-state strategy. Now, we'll see how that plays out in the voting, but clearly, I think these forces have centralized it.
So does that mean, Dean, that all those reasons that New Hampshire uses to stress the importance of its first-in-the-nation status, whether it's that it's a small state or that it does retail politics really, really well, does that start to get irrelevant?
I wouldn't say it's irrelevant. I think we may have to kind of rethink our role a little bit, not necessarily in terms of being first in the nation, but kind of in terms of how the role we play here fits into the bigger, more nationalized picture. It may be that the retail aspect of campaigning is a more compressed part of the schedule. We're just now seeing some candidates really set up shop, in essence. Others have been here a while, but a lot of them are doing this sort of by the seat of their pants. So it may be that our expectations of a long, invisible primary in the state have to be reduced. But I still certainly think that, you know, given technology, given our ability to host debates here in the state, we can play that same role, but we're increasingly playing it for a more national and international audience rather than just for a Granite State audience. I think we'll still be relevant, we'll still be first, but we're going to have to kind of rethink how we fit into this nationalizing trend that we're seeing.
Well, Dean, we have a busy few weeks ahead. Thank you for all the work that you've done for us in the past year and look forward to a lot more political analysis from you in 2012. Have a happy new year.
The same to you, Keith. Happy new year.
Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar at the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. He's also author of the popular website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. New Hampshire voters go to the polls for the First in the Nation primary on January 10th. ...2011 was a year of losses as well. Walter Peterson, who served as governor from 1969 to 1973, passed away this June at the age of 88. George Wilson, the former publisher of the Concord Monitor, died of Alzheimer's disease back in November. And in October, the state lost Perkins Bass. Bass was a founding partner of the law firm Shaheen Finney Bass & Green, a state senate president, a selectman for the town of Peterborough, and in 1954 was elected to the U.S. Congress. To look back at the life of Perkins Bass, I spoke to his son, current 2nd District Congressman Charlie Bass. Congressman Bass, thanks so much for joining us, and very, very sorry about the loss of your father.
Thank you.
Well, your father, Perkins Bass, he was a decorated war veteran, the founder of a law firm, state senate president, and a U.S. congressman, and then after all of that, a selectman for the town of Peterborough. So out of all those titles, was there one that he was the most proud of or that he felt he made the biggest impact on who he was?
After my mother died in 1972, incumbent selectman died, and my dad was appointed to replace him. He subsequently ran for election one more time after that, so he served about 3 or 4 years in selectman. He used to always say to me, I've been in the legislature, I've been in the state senate, I've been in the U.S. Congress, and I've been a selectman of Peterborough. None of those jobs was more difficult than being selectman. And he said it because the reason it was so difficult was that he had to administer the affairs of the town on a almost 24/7 basis. He said that the hardest part, frankly, were the concealed carry permits and the dog complaints. So here was a guy that had been president of the state senate, a U.S. congressman, but he understood that the responsibility of selectman of Peterborough was possibly the most significant of all because it affected so directly the lives of not a lot of people, but people.
So I'm sure he taught you a lot, but what was the one single biggest lesson that your father taught you about politics?
The single biggest lesson that he taught me was that the only way that you can be successful is to learn how to listen and to learn how to understand why people believe what they do. And if you can understand that, then you're ahead of everybody else in solving problems or dealing with issues. He also felt that he and I sort of made up this saying that whoever knows the most wins. It was important to do your homework and to read and to understand an issue. If you know more about a subject than anybody else does, you're in a better position to prevail with your views because you have better justification. But primarily, my father was a listener, and he believed in tolerance.
Well, you were really close to your father, and I'm sure you talked a lot about politics. Were there times that your father and you disagreed on an issue? What was that like?
My father was very much opposed to the action that the U.S. took in Iraq, and he urged me not to get caught up in the post-9/11 frenzy. He was a veteran of World War II. He had served for 2.5 years essentially behind enemy lines working with the Flying Tigers in the Army Air Corps. He saw firsthand the brutality and the injustice that war brings to societies. And he learned, as only a combat veteran can, just how difficult war can be. He used to say to me, it takes 30 seconds to go to war. It takes 30 years to get out of it. And he was right. He also used to say to me that he admired those that were opposed to the Middle East engagement in Iraq and stayed that way, and he had no respect for those that were for it and then against it when it became unpopular. So he was consistent in his view, and we didn't agree on it because I supported the resolution that was proposed by President Bush that gave him the authority to conduct military operations in this region, but he never supported it.
Do you have a favorite story you want to share? I'd love for you to share one of your favorite stories about your father.
I would just say in general, my dad was there for me in the 25 or 30 elections that I won. But the biggest thing about my dad was he was also there when I lost. I lost 3 elections, and the last one I lost was in 2006. And when you lose an election, you're very much alone. There's nobody there. There's no staff. Your family is there, but you have to be a leader, and it's the hardest thing in the world. And my father, when I lost in 2006, instead of standing on the stage behind me, decided to stand in front of me about 20 feet, and he stood there in front of me to give me the support that I needed when I really needed it. And that's what fathers are really for.
That's a great story. Well, you wrote your father's obituary, and one thing that you included was a verse that he kept going back to. It's a passage from the poem Ulysses by Alfred Lord Tennyson. I'd love for you to read that quote and tell me what it was about that passage that rang so close to your father.
Well, my father, we would celebrate milestones in my father's life, his 65th birthday, his 70th birthday, 75th birthday, 80th birthday, 85th birthday, 90th birthday, and he would always drink a toast to the family and so on. And at the end of that, he would always quote the same verse as you mentioned, and it goes as follows. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. I think what that reflects is my father's understanding of his own mortality and the immortality of humanity. He used to say to me when we talked about death or what was going to happen to him after he died, he said, you know, I will be after I die exactly what I was before I was born. And he recognized this human condition, and he lived it. And this phrase from Tennyson, I think, personifies my father's view of life.
Well, again, very sorry about the loss of your father,
thank
Congressman.
You.
And thanks for sitting down and talking with me about it. And have a happy 2012.
Same to you.
Charles Bass is New Hampshire's 2nd District Congressman and son of Perkins Bass, who passed away in October at the age of 99. Also back in June, The Exchange dedicated an entire show to the memory of former New Hampshire Governor Walter Peterson, who we also lost this year. To hear the full show, visit The Exchange page at nhpr.org. I'm Keith Shields. We'll return with more from our New Hampshire Newsmakers of the Year broadcast after a short break. This is The Exchange from NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, from Mascoma Savings Bank, serving the people and needs of the Upper Connecticut River Valley since 1899, online at mascomabank.com. And from the NEEF Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college, information at nhheaf.org. And from the law firm of Rath, Young, and Pignatelli, with best wishes for peace and equity this holiday season. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly cloudy across the state, a few flurries mainly in western and northern counties, highs near 30 degrees in the north, mid-30s in central areas, low 40s in southern New Hampshire. For tonight, light snow and some mixed precipitation in the north with lows 20 to 25 degrees. Central and southwest New Hampshire will have a chance of mixed precipitation with some light icing possible, lows upper 20s. Expect rain in southern New Hampshire with lows in the mid-30s. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Keith Shields, executive producer for The Exchange. Today, for our 9th annual New Hampshire Newsmakers of the Year broadcast, we're looking at those in the Granite State who made headlines in 2011 and exploring what's happened since. This month, Time magazine chose The Protester as its Person of the Year. The Protester took top headlines many times in 2011, from the Arab Spring uprisings to a new movement born in Manhattan's Lower End. On September 17th, about 1,000 people gathered in to protest and occupy Wall Street. In the weeks that followed that day, Occupy movements popped up across the country, including in New Hampshire. Granite Staters gathered in Manchester's Veterans Park for 5 days in October until police disbanded them. But that didn't stop Occupy New Hampshire from continuing. To look back at this journey, I spoke with Sherry Gould, an organizer for the Occupy New Hampshire movement. Well, Sherry Gould, thanks for taking a few minutes to speak with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So you had a physical occupation of Veterans Park for about 5 days back in the middle of October. Police finally enforced an ordinance to decamp. What was your take on what happened in those 5 days? Do you feel like you made a difference?
I do. It was very interesting. It happened very quickly from September 28th till October 15th. There was some planning that happened, a lot of momentum and excitement. We saw broad public support. I was shocked at how quickly the Facebook page grew. A lot of financial support to help with the encampment. A huge rally on October 15th with over 250 people in attendance. Incredible diversity of those people that were there. Just mind-blowing diversity. And everybody noticed who was there. The encampment took place for the 5 days. It certainly raised an awareness in the state of Occupy, which is what the encampments are about. It's a form of our free speech.
So since the encampment broke up here in New Hampshire, what have been some of the big things that Occupy New Hampshire has been up to?
So what we've seen is an explosion of occupations in communities all across the state. Each day, it seems, new communities are popping up. I just was reading this morning an article that was done in the Conway paper, and in the comments section was somebody from Bartlett, New Hampshire. So apparently there's a big dig happening in Bartlett, and citizens who are concerned about that recognized that Occupy was a mechanism they could use to address a problem happening in their community. So I think that there's a lasting message. People get it, that this is a way for direct democracy to take hold. Here in New Hampshire, we know about direct democracy. We've had these town meetings and experiences all of our lives, but we've also seen the erosion of some of that ability of local citizens to govern themselves in their communities.
So has there been a leader or a leading body that has emerged from the group over the past 3 months?
Occupy is a leaderless movement. That doesn't mean that it lacks leadership. There is lateral leadership, and really everybody's a leader. Anyone can have an idea and has the autonomy to form a work group and present their idea at their local General Assembly or to form their own occupation in their own community and get folks to be on board for what their ideas are. So leadership happens constantly. It's very fluid, and direct democracy can look really messy and be bumpy, but there's a lot of leadership that's being exemplified.
Now, do you see any concern in this, though, that if you do lack leadership, especially, as you said, as it's exploding, does that move you away, or is there a fear that that moves you away from the original focus or muddy the message too much?
I don't think so. I think that what we're seeing with the explosion nationwide is that, you know, there's been one universal message from day one, and that's about corporate greed. It's about the impact that has on our political system. So get the money out is a loud, clear message that, from my perspective, we see in every single occupation. I think that's kind of the universal concept.
So do you feel that that's really what the major accomplishment has been over the past 3 months for Occupy New Hampshire, that you really have had an impact on the state and national conversation?
Most certainly. I think that's a major accomplishment. And I think the experience of those people who get involved in the direct democracy has been very powerful for individuals as well. And as that spreads out and more people see that we're not victims and that sitting on the couch and being numbed by the TV shows and playing the games and whatever else society gives us to numb us from what's happening doesn't have to be the status quo, but that people can get up, get active, take their power back, and make real significant changes in their communities.
Okay, well, let's look to the new year, Sherry Gould. What do you see are the big plans for Occupy New Hampshire in 2012?
Well, one of the biggest things is Occupy the primary is happening. So that will be the first big splash in January. If I had a prediction to make, and this is just coming from me and my prediction, the big theme that will come out of Occupy the primary will be get the money out. There'll be lots of messages, but I think that's going to be one loud, strong message that will really brand what happens with the primaries all across the country with the Occupy movements. You will see beyond that a continued spread among local communities. I think at town meetings, there'll be a lot of impact happening in terms of warrant articles and people practicing their democracy in their own communities.
Well, best of luck to you. Thanks so much, Sherry Gould, for sitting down with me, and have a happy new year.
The same to you. Thank you.
Sherry Gould is an organizer for the Occupy New Hampshire movement. I sat down with her last week. Two times in 2011, hundreds of thousands of Granite Staters were left in the dark. In August, Hurricane Irene barreled up the East Coast. By the time it reached New Hampshire, it was reduced to a tropical storm. But that didn't stop it from knocking down trees, damaging homes, and cutting power lines. Then, over the Halloween weekend, a major snowstorm dumped upwards of 2 feet of snow to cities and towns all over southern New Hampshire. Snowtober, as it was nicknamed, took many by surprise, and in the end ranked third overall in the number of residents in our state without power at its peak. To look back at these two storms and their subsequent cleanup, I spoke with Martin Murray, Senior Corporate News Representative for Public Service of New Hampshire. Martin Murray, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, who can predict the weather? So who would have thought that there would be a major tropical storm in August, followed 8 weeks later by a monumental snowstorm at the end of October? Which out of the two gave you the greatest challenge?
I would have to say that the snowstorm actually gave us the greatest amount of challenges. No one expected or anticipated the amount of snow that was delivered. And it frankly caught weather forecasters as well as utilities, as well as customers, a bit by surprise. Recall that the tropical storm Irene was a hurricane, and it seemed like we were all watching that on CNN and the Weather Channel for like, you know, a year, watching it come up the coast. Everyone was ready. We were lined up. We had the crews. We had the damage, and it was substantial, and it took days to get all customers back, but it wasn't unexpected, Keith. And I think what happened in October, and one of the reasons people criticized us and tempers were a bit short with some people, was that it was like, how could this happen again? How could we lose power for days? And it really was because it impacted a large amount of the region. It caused substantial damage, and it took the time that it took in order to repair that damage.
Well, it seems like over the past 5 years, we've had a bunch of once-in-a-century events that have resulted in major electrical outages, a very bad windstorm, an ice storm, major floods. What have you learned from these previous storms that you felt you were able to apply to two more once-in-a-century weather events that happened in 2011?
We learned a couple of things. One, we learned that we do a really good job, actually, of restoring power when there's a lot of damage. So we did learn that, a little pat on the back to a lot of people. But we also learned, Keith, how important it is for communication to be effective in terms of keeping things going for our customers and municipalities. And what I mean by that is people can understand that it might take a couple of days to restore power, but they want to hear that. They want to hear from us or from others explaining why the power is out and how long it might take to make the repairs. So long as that dialogue is occurring, they're okay. If they're hearing nothing, they're incredibly frustrated. So that became quite apparent after the ice storm of 2008, and we've worked to improve that every storm since.
Well, Martin, a lot of progress, but PSNH, along with the state's other electrical companies, received some criticism, especially during the October snowstorm, in that it took some people 6 days to restore power to their homes. How do you feel about that criticism? Do you find it's a valid one?
We restored people in a record amount of time, much faster than the federal government, for example, the Department of Energy, expects us to do given the damage. This was our third biggest storm in terms of the number of customers that were without power, 237,000 at one time on that Sunday, October 30. We restored 50,000 people 24 hours later and another 50,000 24 hours after that. By day six, we had restored 99.9% of the customers. So we think we did a terrific job. But again, Keith, I go back to the fact that this storm hit almost the same exact area that had been hit by Tropical Storm Irene. So many of these customers were experiencing their second significant outage in less than an eight-week period. That's frustrating. So it doesn't surprise me that people would criticize us because we're the likely target. But then again, we don't own the trees. We try to maintain other people's trees if they give us permission, but it's the trees. It's not our infrastructure that's causing the problems.
Well, Martin, who knows what 2012 may hold? Earthquakes, hurricanes, solar flares. What do we feel we learned this year that we may be able to apply for the first major weather event in 2012?
Well, you didn't mention volcanoes. So. Well, I think what we learned primarily is that when you have a widespread impact across the region, it is difficult to get boots on the ground from other areas to help us out quickly. We do need lots of other soldiers to help us when we have a significant power outage. But if it's impacting all of New England, New York, and New Jersey. Where do you get that help from if everyone needs that extra help? So I think we're all going to be working together to try to improve, if possible, that kind of mutual aid situation and to have a good, solid plan for getting extra help if it's possible.
Well, here's to gentle breezes and calmer weather in 2012. Martin Murray, thanks so much for joining me, and have a happy new year.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Martin Murray is Senior Corporate News Representative for Public Service of New Hampshire. And finally, the Exchange reached a milestone as well, as we celebrated our 15th year on the air. During that time, we sat down with presidential candidates, state politicians, business leaders, big thinkers, economists, scientists, biographers, and many more. All year, the Exchange has celebrated its 15th anniversary. We had a big gala event, along with our special series, The Exchange Yearbook. To reflect a little on the Exchange and her role in it, I sat down with our host, Laura Kanoy. Well, Laura Kanoy, we have a major role reversal here. So for the first and probably only time, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
Well, I want you to go back to that first day on the air at New Hampshire Public Radio. If you were there and then could look forward to today, 15 years down the road, what would it be about the Exchange that would have surprised you the most about how the show has evolved?
Wow. Well, a lot would surprise me. I thought at the time that we would produce a good product, that people would listen, that people would call. But I never imagined, Keith, that our studios here at NHPR would become the place where statewide conversations occur, where people from all walks of life and all different philosophies will come together and try to untangle these issues that matter to our daily lives. I guess I never imagined that we would become such an important part of the public policy dialogue here in the Granite State.
So outside of just how one gets better at their craft by doing something for 15 years, in what ways do you feel that you've grown the most as a host?
I think I have a lot more confidence, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, 16 years behind the mic, you'll get that. One of the things that was hard for me when I first started was interrupting people. As you know, I'm a minister's daughter. I was raised with very good manners, to be very polite and respectful. So interrupting people does not come naturally to me. And that was something I really had to work on, finding that right balance of interrupting at the right time, but not interrupting too much, because you hear hosts doing that. It just doesn't sound good. It's disjointed. So that's been tough. The other area that I think I've grown as a host is just understanding the issues that are so important to people in New Hampshire, just understanding the context. I mean, the headlines change day to day, but there's a depth and a context and a history. And after 16 years behind the mic here, I think I get New Hampshire.
All year, Laura, we have been celebrating the 15th year anniversary of the Exchange. And I'm wondering, in this year of celebrating and looking back, if you've learned something new about our show through this year of reflection.
Well, it has been a really great process to kind of go back and go, oh, I remember that show. And I remember the Brock impeachment early in the decade. And I remember the ice storms and all the things that have happened. I've been impressed, I have to say, at how much we follow the news and we create conversations around that news. I would say we've become a lot more professional, a lot more focused on news and policy. But I would also say, Keith, that even though early on, yeah, there were a lot of bumps and kinks and we did a lot of shows we probably shouldn't have done, like the bagel show, the cheese show, the beer show. We don't do that anymore. But our values have not changed. We engage in conversations that create a more informed public. That's our mission. And that has not changed, even though we're a lot better at doing that today than we were 16 years ago.
So instead of looking back now, Laura, take a look forward as we head closer to the 20th, the 25th, the 30th anniversaries. What are your hopes for the Exchange down the road?
Well, that's a great question. And boy, we could talk about that forever. I'd like to look at those stories that aren't necessarily making headlines,
But they are being talked about in our communities, at our town meetings, at our office water coolers, while people are having lunch with friends or out hiking or skiing in the state. I want to find out, Keith, what are people talking about? What's on Granite Staters' minds that we're not discussing on the exchange, that isn't maybe making a headline on the front page or the second page? So I'd love to dig into that a little bit more. I would also like to make the connection more with Washington policy and how it affects New Hampshire. Really, Congress is talking about this. Okay, Granite State, listen up. This is how it's going to affect us here in New Hampshire. So those are some big, broad goals for the new year.
Because really, that's what the exchange is about. It's about what New Hampshire is talking about.
Right.
Well, Laura, probably for the last time here, happy 15th anniversary, and here's to another year of great programs for 2012.
Thanks, Keith. It's been fun.
As I'm sure you probably know, Laura Kanoy is the host of The Exchange. Well, that wraps up The Exchange for 2011. We hope you keep listening in the coming year. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The producers this year were Ellen Grimm and Will Roselip. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. We'd like to thank our interns this year, Ryan Lassard, Karen Goll, Charlotte Evans, and Kristen Leffler. And especially to our incredible and dedicated volunteer, Priscilla Malcolm. We'd like to thank our fill-in hosts this year, John Greenberg, Wayne Lesbruns, Abby Goldstein, and Elaine Grant. And I'm Keith Shields, executive producer for The Exchange. Laura Kanoy returns to her seat on January 3rd. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR, and have a happy new year.